Well, greetings to those of you that are watching at Bush Lake and at West Tonka, and those of you that are watching online, including my granddaughter, Carter, who may be watching in this very moment. My name is Dale Dree. As was mentioned, I'm the formation pastor here at Westwood. I came back to Westwood about a year ago. I say I came back because I was I was the outreach pastor here at Westwood, the first outreach pastor. Well, Pastor Joel has entrusted me with the message today, and we continue in this teaching series entitled Be in Love, which is shorthand for Westwood's way of life, be in love like Jesus. And in this series, we're answering the question, yes, but how? Be in love like Jesus, I think we would all agree, yes, but how? How do we practically do that? My parents didn't know it when I was born. My grandparents didn't notice it about me when I would visit as a toddler. My kindergarten teacher didn't flag it on my report card. My third grade teacher, and my fifth grade teacher all knew that something was amiss, but they did not know what was causing it. I wasn't able to read and write at my grade level, which meant for me, school was a lot like a Charlie Brown cartoon. You ever watch the Charlie Brown cartoons and the teacher in a classroom said, the teacher goes, wah, 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 wah. Have you ever seen that? Yeah. But the students always, like, you're watching, they know what this teacher said and can answer or whatever. But for me, it was all wah, 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 wah. And years of wah, 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 wah had impressed into my inner sense of myself a destructive message. I am defective. I mean, I must be defective because my teachers, they work hard, my parents work hard, I work really hard, but I just cannot get it. Well, thankfully, by God's grace, in sixth grade, God provided a teacher for me that changed everything. She had just finished some additional education and something that was new back in that day called learning disabilities. I say back in that day because this is 1974, and yes, I am that old. Well, she quickly detected that I have dyslexia and diagnosed it, and she also gave me skills to begin to overcome that particular learning disability. But in spite of the fact that I had that diagnosis, and besides the fact that over the next few years I began to gradually overcome, I still had this internal message in my center of my being, and it was, I'm defective, I'm defective, I'm defective. And I told myself that message over and over and over again. I wonder, do you have an internal dialogue of some sort, something that you tell yourself over and over again? Maybe you have an incredibly positive internal dialogue. I mean, you say very beautiful things to yourself, maybe things that are about who you are in Christ. But no doubt, because we live in a fallen, broken world, there are times when, even in spite of your positive internal dialogue, you get ground down and you are tempted to allow it to become a very negative dialogue. Maybe you have a positive dialogue and it gets ground down at times, but maybe you're more like I am. You've internalized something from a trauma in your life that has led you to have a negative internal dialogue. Maybe your internal dialogue is about God. God is mad at me. God has abandoned me. Maybe your negative internal dialogue isn't about God, but it's about yourself, like mine was. Mine was, I am defective, but maybe yours is, I am not enough. I'm going to fail. Maybe your negative internal dialogue isn't about God or about yourself, but it's about others. Everyone thinks I'm weird. They would never let me be part of their group. Maybe your destructive internal dialogue isn't about God or yourself or about others, but it's about your place in the world. And you tell yourself over and over again, God could never use me. I could never make a real difference in this world. Maybe I have no idea what your internal dialogue is, positive or negative, but I do believe we have them. And I do believe that we are all tempted at times to revert to and internalize and receive and begin to practice a negative internal dialogue that is destructive. Have you ever wondered what Jesus' internal dialogue was? Ever wondered if Jesus was tempted to internalize a destructive dialogue about himself? Today we continue in our teaching series, Be in Love, in which we are looking at what does it take to truly be in love like Jesus? And we're noticing that in order to truly be in love like Jesus, we have to be the people who can move in four different directions. We have to be the kind of people who can, with open hands, receive God's love, and then with open hands, give love to God, an up movement. And Pastor Clint last week reminded us about that and our invitation to respond to God's love by responding with worship to God. But there's another movement that we must make after that first movement up. We also must make a movement within, and it's one that we often miss, that we must, with open hands, receive from God God's love, and then with open hands, give God's love to ourselves. And we're going to see how Jesus did that today. And next week, Pastor Joel will be back, and he will take us through this movement in towards one another, that we must be the kind of people who with open hands receive God's love, and then with open hands we give God's love to one another in authentic community and with generosity. And then in 2 weeks, Pastor Claire will be here, and she will wrap up our teaching series on Be in Love, and she will look at this movement out, that we must be the kind of people, if we truly want to be like Jesus, we must with open hands receive God's love, and then with open hands give God's love to a very broken and very fallen world and to our neighbors. And I hang this all on what is actually an equilateral triangle. Do you remember this from, like, you know, way back in school? Equilateral triangles are all equal on, you know, the sides, because these are all equally important if we hope to be and love like Jesus. But today we're going to focus on within. How do we become the kind of people who with open hands receive God's love and then with open hands give God's love to ourselves? And to answer that question, I want us to look together at what I believe was Jesus' internal dialogue. And I want to take us to a story, the story of Jesus' baptism. This event takes place in Jesus' life and when he's about 30 years old. And up until this time, he's lived a very private life. But now, after this event, everything is going to go public. And he's going to begin his public ministry where he'll travel from town to town, and he will announce the good news, the gospel, that the kingdom of heaven is breaking into the kingdoms of this world with a new and expanded power, a power that is able to carve out a group of people and a work that serves as a sign that points to a future time when Jesus will come back and he will make all things new. But now it is possible in his kingdom to be making things new. And Jesus will have this public ministry, but before he does that, and before he heals people, which is evidence of this power, and before he does miracles, which is evidence of this kingdom power at work on earth, Jesus has this moment with his Abba, with his Father, at his baptism. And in that moment, I believe, we learn Jesus' internal dialogue about himself. Are you ready to hear his internal dialogue? I would invite you to stand, if you're able, for the public reading of our scriptures. This is Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 to 17. Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, "I need to be baptized by you, and you come to me?" Jesus replied, "Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness." Then John consented. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. And at that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. In him I am well pleased." Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 to 17. You may be seated. In Jesus' baptism, he feels the Spirit touch him, and then he hears the voice of his Father, his Abba, speak from heaven these words over him: "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." There's a bookend to this, his Son, child of the Father. Very pleasing. But right in the middle is this phrase translated here, whom I love. It's a translation of the Greek word agapetos. Repeat it after me. Agape. Tos. Agapetos. This particular word, which is in the center, and in the center, I believe, of Jesus' entire identity and his own internal dialogue, can mean a number of different things. It could mean a sense of, like, esteemed, which is beautiful and wonderful, or dearly loved, but my favorite translation is beloved. The New American Standard, in its translation of this particular sentence, says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." The Father reveals this truth to everybody who's watching, but I don't think it was new to Jesus. He had heard this over and over and over and over again. You are my child, you are beloved, you are pleasing to me. And Jesus, I believe, internalized this dialogue such that he began to refer to himself as God's beloved. It's interesting, this particular word, agapetos, appears 61 times in the New Testament. It's used 6 times of Jesus to reveal to us that at the center of who Jesus was a sense of being God's beloved. But it's used another 55 times to refer to us as followers of Jesus. When Jesus, Abba, his Father, becomes our Father, Jesus' dialogue about himself as God's beloved should become our internal dialogue too. And the Apostle Paul, who writes a letter to the church in Rome, he gets this and he draws this out and he double clicks on this whole idea of eternal internal dialogue. And he says this to the church in Rome: "The Spirit you receive brought about your adoption. And by him we cry, Abba, Father." Maybe that word kind of jumps out at you. Abba, he kisses me. What is that? It's Aramaic, ironically. Jesus' first language was Aramaic. It was his heart language. And this is the word that Jesus consistently referred to his Father with, Abba. And Paul quotes Jesus here in this moment, because the Spirit you received brought about your adoption, and by that Spirit we cry what Jesus cries, Abba, Father. And the Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. Paul has in mind here a courtroom scene where our internal dialogue is on trial. And the Spirit rises up as a witness and testifies to our spirit that we are God's beloved children. And then Paul says, now if we are children, then we are heirs. Heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. What Jesus gets as an inheritance, we get. And part of Jesus' inheritance is that he is Abba's child. He is God's beloved. He is pleasing to his Father. And so Paul says, we are heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ if indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory. And there's a whole sermon there that I won't do. What is your internal dialogue about yourself? Do you believe at the center of who you are is the reality that you are God's beloved one? Many years ago, I went through an extreme burnout experience in my early 30s. And during that time, God stripped me away from all the things that I was using to define myself. And in that place, God revealed to me for the first time that I had this internal dialogue that said to myself, I said to myself over and over again, I am defective, I am defective, I am defective. But it was also during this season where God began to rewire and change the language that I began to say to myself from I am defective to I am God's beloved. One of the authors that God used during this particular season was an author by the name of Brandon Manning. And Brandon wrote a number of books that I really appreciated, but in one of his books, he told a story that really, really resonated with me. It comes from his book, The Wisdom of Tenderness, and the story goes like this. Several years ago, Edward Farrell of Detroit took his 2-week summer vacation to Ireland to celebrate his uncle's 80th birthday. On the morning of the great event, Ed and his uncle got up early, dressed in the dark, and then in silence made their way to walk along the shores of Lake Killarney. Just as the sun rose, His uncle stood and stared straight at the rising orb. Ed stood behind him for 20 minutes with not a word spoken or exchanged. Then the elderly uncle, get this, began to skip along the shoreline. Can you see an 80-year-old man skipping along the shoreline with a smile on his face? After catching up to him, Edward commented, "Uncle Seamus, you look very happy today. Do you want to tell me why?" "Yes, lad," the old man said, with tears streaming down his face. "You see, this father is very fond of me. Ah, me father is so very fond of me." Here's an 80-year-old man who still believes in the core of his being he is Abba's child, he is beloved, and he is pleasing to his father. Do you believe that in the core of your being? Does it impact you so deeply that it has transformed your internal dialogue? Do you say to yourself regularly, "I am God's beloved"? Now, an interesting thing happens immediately after Jesus' baptism. The Spirit literally draws Jesus out into the desert, into the wilderness, and there for 40 days, Jesus fasts. And then the Father allows the enemy, the adversary, Satan, to come and to test Jesus and to tempt Jesus. We aren't told if he comes in physical form or if he comes into the life, kind of the thought life of Jesus, but we do know that he comes to test Jesus and tempt Jesus in three different ways. And each of the first two, he begins with the phrase, "If you are the Son of God." Satan is tempting Jesus to doubt his identity as God's beloved, and instead to replace his core identity with something else. And to summarize these three kind of for us today, I would say the temptations that the enemy comes to us with, just as he came to Jesus, is to find our ultimate identity in someplace other than in God and in our belovedness. And one of the ones is to find our identity in what we do. It's also to find our identity in what other people say about us. And finally, it's also in this temptation to find our identity in what we can control. The first temptation, the enemy comes and says to Jesus, "Turn stones into bread." Joe Saxton, who is an author and a Bible teacher, she wrote a wonderful book called More Than Enchanted. And she writes, she talks in a discipleship group that I was part of. She was talking to us and she was noticing in this passage that, like, Jesus hasn't really done anything for 40 days. Like, he's just been wasting his time out in the wilderness, kind of wandering around, and we would say, like, he didn't really get anything done for a whole month, and plus, you know, kind of thing. And she was noticing that the enemy comes and immediately tempts Jesus to do something, to get productive. Do something about that hunger you're feeling. Turn stones into bread. The enemy comes, and it's a real temptation to us to find our identity not in our belovedness, but in what we do. To help teach us more about that, Tammy Stordahl, who is one of the associate pastors here at Westwood, is going to come and share some of her story and how this worked out in her life.
Thanks, Dale. Well, most people at church think that I'm an extrovert. I think it's because my laugh is so loud, and people will often say, "I knew you were here because I heard you laughing." But really, I'm an introvert, and I need space to recharge, and I need a nap today after doing this for three times. As a kid, I was super shy, and my kindergarten teacher told my mom she was very concerned that I was very slow to make friends. And this shyness also kept me from trying new things. I was afraid to get called out or be embarrassed in front of people. And I would never raise my hand unless I was 100% sure I knew the answer. I had this inner voice saying, "If I can't do it right, I'm not even going to try." As an adult, this grew, and eventually the combination of needing to do things right my high sense of responsibility and very rarely saying no led me to a season where I hit the wall and I crashed. I didn't question God's love for me at all, but I had this inner drive to do what was perfect no matter what it took. I took pride in doing things well, and honestly, I got a lot of praise for it. Once I crashed, I began looking inside with the help of a few people, and I learned a lot about myself, and I learned a lot about God during that time. And I'm just going to share four of the things that stand out to me. One, God reaffirmed that he simply loves me because he does, not because of what I do. Two, God wants me to use the gifts he has given me as an outflow of his love in my life, and not out of pride or obligation or expectation of others. Three, I came to understand that I need to know God to truly know myself, and I need to truly know myself to know God. They're intertwined. And as an essential part of knowing myself, I need to believe that I am God's beloved child. And then fourth, being with God and taking care of my soul are both essential to my belovedness instead of the old tapes that are within my head. There's been a trend that I've seen on social media of people saying my biggest toxic trait is this, and they just lighthearted something, they poke fun at themselves. But the other day I saw one that made me pause. It said, my biggest toxic trait is I know how to love, but I don't know how to believe I am loved. And maybe some of us can relate to that today. Part of looking within is looking at the false things that are keeping us from believing our belovedness. And I love this quote by Brennan Manning in his book, Abba's Child. Define yourself radically as one beloved by God. This is the true self. Every other identity is an illusion. So who am I? I'm a daughter. I'm a sister. I'm a pretty good aunt. I'm a friend. I'm a pastor. I'm a recovering perfectionist. And ultimately, I'm a beloved child of God, just like you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
We have an enemy who roams around seeking to kill and destroy. And one of the ways the enemy seeks to kill and destroy is to tempt us to find our identity not in our belovedness, but in what we do. What's a spiritual practice that you could pick up or continue that would help you deal with the temptation to find your identity in what you do? I suggest to you that maybe there's a reason God gave us the gift of Sabbath. Sabbath is a time where we weekly set aside time to just be, to be a human being, not a human doing, to say no to things that might want to define us, whether it's work or a particular recreational activity or whatever it is, just to stop. When my wife and I were younger and we had young kids, and even when we were single, we tried to do this, and we could find, you know, maybe some time each week. And when the kids were young, you know, it was a certain small amount of time, but we did it weekly. We named it. We called it Sabbath. We're older now. We're empty nesters. And so now we can do like a 24-hour Sabbath. Doesn't that sound amazing? I shouldn't probably tell you this, but yes, we try to. Not every week, but pretty close. This coming week, we have our granddaughter, so who knows? But it's a gift. It reminds us. We are not ultimately what we do. We are ultimately God's beloved. The second temptation that Satan inflicts upon Jesus is that he takes Jesus to the highest place on the temple, which is also the highest place in all of Jerusalem. And there at that highest place, he invites Jesus with all the crowds looking on, because there were always huge crowds at the temple, and you could see this even throughout all of Jerusalem, and he invites Jesus to throw himself off the temple and to be caught by angels. Imagine if Jesus had done that. Imagine what people would have been saying. I mean, if it was captured on video today and it was posted on, you know, like social media, it would be, you know, it'd go viral, right? I checked in last service, that's the right term. I'm not a social media person, but I think viral is the right term. Jesus is invited to do something spectacular so that he can get the reaction of the people. I think the temptation to find our identity in what other people say about us has always been here, but with the advent of social media, it's on steroids, is it not? So many people look to find their sense of identity and worth and well-being from what other people say about them, whether it's a thumbs up or a thumbs down, a like or a dislike. But God comes to us and says, "You are my beloved. You are not what other people say about you, good or bad." What's a spiritual practice that could help us be able to resist the temptation to find our identity in what other people say about us? I suggest to you that the spiritual practice of solitude, being alone with God, is a powerful tool that, if you did it regularly, would help you resist the temptation to find your identity in what other people say. Henry Nouwen, in his book, in which he talks about his own personal time of burnout, says this about the role of solitude in his life. He says, "In solitude, I get rid of my scaffolding. No friends to talk with, no telephone calls to make, no meetings to attend, no music to entertain, no books to distract, just me, naked, vulnerable, weak, sinful, deprived, broken, nothing. A nothingness so dreadful that everything in me wants to run to my friends, my work, and my distractions so that I can forget my nothingness and make myself believe that I am worthy of something. The wisdom of the desert is that the confrontation with our own frightening nothingness forces us to surrender ourselves totally and unconditionally to the Lord Jesus Christ." In solitude, we have nothing except God. And in solitude, we distract from the scaffolding of what other people are saying about us. Do you keep a regular rhythm of Sabbath that reminds you that you are not what you do? Do you have some kind of regular rhythm of practicing solitude which can remind you you are not what other people say about you? But there is a third temptation that the enemy brings to Jesus and brings into our life that wants to tempt us to find our identity not in our belovedness, but instead in what we can control. The third temptation, Satan shows Jesus all the kingdoms of the world that he has influence over and seeks to control. And before Jesus begins his public ministry, in which he's going to announce that the kingdom of heaven is breaking into the kingdoms of this world with a new and expanded power that is so powerful, it can push back the enemy. The enemy comes and offers Jesus all the kingdoms of this world, all the control. But Jesus says no. He says no to the kingdom of heaven being accomplished in and through the kingdoms and the countries of this world. His kingdom is not of this world. And so he says no. And in that rebuke of Satan, in that moment, Satan flees, and the angels come and they tend to Jesus. This temptation to find our identity in control is offered to Jesus in this moment. Judith Haugen, in her book, Transformed into Fire, Discovering Our True Identity as God Beloved, she unpacks each of these temptations of Jesus in her book. And when she talks about this temptation of the kingdoms of this world, which seems kind of abstract, doesn't it? It's a little hard to get our brains around, says this about it. She says, "The primary difference between the false self, an identity based on something other than our belovedness, and the true self, an identity based on belovedness, can be best rendered or seen in relationship to power. One is concerned with the love of power, false self, and the other, the true self, is concerned with the power of love. And for the false self, what is the nature of its power? One word, control. The false self enjoys and, in fact, needs to feel in charge of its surroundings. Often this drives for control works itself out in subtle ways through shaming and manipulation, cloaked in apparent virtue or Christian concern." Have you ever given in to the temptation to find your ultimate identity in what you can control? What you can make work out the way you want it to work out? Often we know that we've given in to the false temptation of control when we use manipulation and shame to try to make it work out the way we want it to. How can we resist the temptation to find our identity in what we control? In this story, Jesus spends an extensive time in fasting. In fasting, we give up control of our desire and our control over our diet and over food. In fasting, we give up that. Fasting doesn't just have to be in food. It can be anything that desires to control you or you desire to control, like maybe your phone or your social media account. In giving that up, we put ourselves in a place where we learn and relearn that we are God's beloved. We are not what we can control. My spiritual director likes to say, I am broken and I am beloved, but only one of those is eternal. That's a word, isn't it? We are broken, but we are also beloved. And only that is eternal. Imagine if we allowed that eternal truth to seep so deep into our being that we replaced our internal dialogue with eternal dialogue. Dialogue that said, I am God's beloved. I am God's beloved. I am God's beloved. If you struggle a little bit with how to like work this out into your life, I want to offer you two practical suggestions as I conclude. One is you could text the word within to this number on the screen, and we are going to provide throughout this week a set of prompts for you. You can do as little as one or as many as four that will put you in a place through activities to be in a place to hear God remind you of your belovedness. And later this fall, we're going to offer two courses. One is entitled Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. It's going to be run at Bush Lake on Wednesday nights, but it's open to anybody and everybody. And the amazing Jennifer Shainrock is teaching it, and it reminds us and teaches us about belovedness. The other course we're going to run here at Chan during the 10:30 hour, this hour, it's called The Practicing the Way. And it's a practical course that can teach and train you how to live into your belovedness through spiritual practices. It's also a course that's available online, so if you want to gather some friends together and do it together, it's totally a plug-and-play kind of course, something you could do on your own with a group of friends. But whatever it is, would I encourage you to take a next step, to do something this week to remind you of your belovedness? Write a post-it note, maybe. Put a reminder in your phone that just says and pops up, beloved, because we are broken and we are beloved, but only beloved is eternal. So let's let that define who we ultimately are. Will you pray with me? I'm going to invite you to pray a prayer that Brennan Manning used to teach. It's a breathing prayer. Just invite you to breathe in one time. And breathe out. This time as you breathe in, pray the word Abba. Breathe out, I belong to you. Breathe in, Abba. Breathe out, I belong to you. Breathe in, Abba. Breathe out, I belong to you. Amen.